From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, March the 2nd, 2020, one day before two big events on the political scene of Vermont. Of course, Town Meeting Day comes up tomorrow, every first Tuesday in March, and a tradition that extends back into the mists of history here in New England and in Vermont, and it's really a continually strong tradition in Vermont, although we may talk a little bit over the next couple of days about the challenges facing it, mainly having people not so much work on the farm anymore. They're off doing their jobs in other places, frequently commuting out of town. It makes it tougher to get to town meeting. Town meeting attendance actually has been down in recent years. We may chat about that a bit. One of our guests tomorrow is going to be Governor Jim Douglas, who was the moderator for decades in Middlebury. And maybe he'll give us some historical perspective about all that. On today's program, we're going to start out with an hour-long conversation about what's going on in Vermont's educational system. This is sort of the first, I think, that we're going to find out the first real round of post-Act 46. Whoops, I almost mentioned a different law completely. Post-Act 46 town meetings in Vermont, and so how are districts really adjusting now that the dust has started to settle after that school merger law created so much controversy over the last few years. My first guest will be Lola Duffert in just a couple of minutes, joined later this hour by Joanna Doria of Ripton, who's a parent in the Addison Central Supervisory Union, and we had an interesting conversation the other day. I decided to bring her on the radio just to sort of express the view that seems to be common in a lot of districts around Vermont, that parents need to be listened to a little more assiduously by their local school boards, and we'll find out what her thoughts are later this hour. In the second hour today, we are going to be joined by, kind of change the focus to the other half of tomorrow's big happenings, which is, of course, Super Tuesday primaries. Vermont does participate, one of the 14 states around the country, joining the effort to choose a nominee to face off against Donald Trump in the general election this year. Bernie Sanders still leads in the delegates. Joe Biden had a big night in South Carolina on Saturday and gained some ground. And will Biden's momentum continue? Will Sanders hold him off? Will Sanders get enough of the share of the delegates and out of all the states to go to the convention this summer and be able to tell his fellow Democrats, even if you don't like me very much, I'm your nominee? And so that'll be our second hour conversation will be with Trish Siplon. Patricia Siplon is a professor of political science at St. Michael's College, and I'm sure have an interesting conversation with her. As always, we welcome our calls from our listeners. And while I'm sort of filibustering here for a moment, I am also going to mention a little programming note. We have town meeting and Super Tuesday coverage on WDEV will include really focused Tuesday night after high school basketball. High school basketball is going to our coverage rather will go from about 8:30 to 10 on Tuesday night. Lee Cattell, Joel Nashman, and WDEV's director of social media Dylan Deloge will have election results throughout our listening area. We will also join our partners at CBS News Radio for coverage of Super Tuesday results. So it's going to be an excellent round of coverage both nationally and locally Tuesday evening on WDEV. All right, well, let's start with today's show. And Lola Duffert, education reporter with vtdigger.org, is in our tiny studio sitting right across the table from you. Good morning, Lola.
Good morning. Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. It's great to be able to pick your brain about what's going on in Vermont schools, because I don't know if anybody else in the state follows them with quite the breadth and depth that you do on a daily basis. One of the great things about vtdigger.org is that they really focus on having specialized beats for their reporters. Elizabeth Gribkoff covering environmental and energy issues, you covering education, several other reporters, Ann Wallace Allen following what's going on in the business world in Vermont. It's a great thing that a news organization can still have really dedicated beat reporters like that who can develop an expertise in their area, and you certainly have in education. So do I have it roughly right, just in the overall arc of history kind of discussion here, that this is really the first round of town meetings here in 2020 that we are, you know, that Act 46 is kind of all settled now?
Yeah, I mean, Act 46 is kind of settled. this will be the first town meeting post all the forced marriages.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we'll see. You know, I think one of the most, the easiest kind of top line thing to look at is how many budgets get voted up or down. You know, that kind of gives you this very rough indicator of how restive people are locally.
Yeah. Is there peace in the valley or not?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we'll see if an above, you know, average number of budgets get voted down. You know, the forced marriages were the most awkward couples, often the, you know, situations where you had communities that were really very different coming together. And, you know, I've certainly heard anecdotally that that's created some kind of tough conversations around budgeting, because that's when you get down to the brass tacks of, okay, who gets what?
And who pays what?
And who pays what, yeah. So we shall see, you know, Wednesday if, you know, communities were able to come together and actually vote for a more collective vision.
One of the things I wanted to do with this first hour also is really open the phone lines to our listeners, because I know that a lot of folks in individual communities out there around the WDEV listing area are following their local school budgets closely. Do you have any bond issues going on? Do you have specific issues in the schools? I know there's been a lot of consternation about announced layoffs in some school districts around Vermont. The sort of a routine here where if the budget isn't settled by X date, then pink slips have to go out to all these teachers.
Right.
Oftentimes it's a, you know, 10 favorite teachers of, you know, there's a favorite band director or a favorite French teacher or something who's on the list.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the public turns out. And what usually happens there, Lola?
Well, often, you know, administrators discover that, oh, more people are going to retire than we thought, and we can save that favorite band director, digital media, you know, teacher. That certainly happened over in Harwood, mm-hmm. where they had to send out pink slips because they are looking at layoffs, and that's because they're consolidating their middle school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and you often see this. And we are, you know, going to be seeing, I think, probably another round of layoffs in the budgets that are before voters this year. And that's because enrollment continues to, you know, decline. So you're seeing school districts that are trying to right size and also kind of consolidate programming. And Harwood is kind of just an interesting version of that, or illustrative example, in that sometimes school districts are, you know, trying to save programming by cutting down on what they would consider to be duplicative teaching staff.
Mm-hmm.
So it will probably be kind of tough for a lot of school districts out there.
Yeah, now in the Harwood situation, do you know if the talk of closing the Faiston school is still in play? That's not on the ballot this year, right?
That's not on the ballot. The school board there has basically voted to say that they plan to close it, but they can't officially do it, I think, for another year,
mm-hmm.
Just because of the articles of agreement. So they've basically indicated publicly that that's kind of their plan, but they can't officially do it. So Faiston will be open next year.
So push hasn't quite come to shove there, but it's still, a lot of people are pretty riled. I mean, that's my sense of what the latest is.
A lot of people are really riled. Mm-hmm. And again, this is something that we're seeing in a lot of places. Lot of kind of newly merged districts are really looking at their full footprint and wondering whether or not it makes sense to have as many schools as they do. A lot of places are also thinking of repurposing often their elementary, you know, one of their elementary schools for early childhood education as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of the conversation in Harwood. That's been part of the conversation in Chittenden and East. And I would suspect that it's, you know, from talking to superintendents, it's my impression that that is increasingly going to be part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to me. And by the way, you know, once again, 244-1777 is the call-in number here at WDEV. And You know, we are right here in Waterbury in the Harwood District, and I know that there are listeners out there who have been following closely. And if you have updates you'd like to supply us with, if you have any pitches you want to make to your neighbors about vote this way or vote that way on the budget or et cetera. And similar situation in the Addison Central Supervisor Union, just as another example, I think, of really a kind of a statewide trend here of districts really having to, as you said, Lola, looking at their footprint, kind of examining. I think of it almost as pruning a tree with the idea of saving it, maybe cutting off the branch that has some mold on it or something and hoping that you can get the other branches to grow more, get more of the nutrients and grow more strongly. Or in this case, nutrients in schools usually amounts to money, tax dollars. And that is one way to bring the discussion kind of into that metaphor that I think that sort of applies here. I mean, in the case of the Addison Central Union, as I mentioned, Joanna Doria, who lives in Ripton, is a parent of a couple of young children who are actually, I don't think they're yet quite school age, but she's obviously looking at helping to populate the local school in a few years here. Mm-hmm. She's gotten very involved, as have others, and she talked about a group. I was talking with her on the phone yesterday. She was talking about a group called Save Our Schools, and the Addison Central Supervisory Union is basically Middlebury and I think six surrounding small towns, Ripton and Shoreham and others. I can't remember the whole list, but
right. Weybridge, Cornwall.
There you go.
I'm missing a couple.
Yeah, you're better than I am though. So in this school district, same sort of discussion as we've heard in the Harwood district, where parents are zeroing in and they're saying, or the school board's zeroing in and saying, do we need to close one or two of our small outlying elementary schools and have the kids travel a little farther every morning? And many cases, if for whatever reason the kids aren't taking the bus, the parents are traveling more because they're driving their kids to school. Mm-hmm. So it's a real upheaval in many Vermont's small towns that's still going on. Is there any sense in we talked about at the beginning about the overall kind of arc of Act 46, is there any sense that any of these districts are still possibly going to be unraveled, or are they pretty much what they're going to be?
I think they're pretty much going to be what they want to be. I think there's one, there's a group of school districts that are trying to get divorced down south, and I think they're going to petition the State Board of Education. So I guess that is possible. I haven't heard. I mean, there's certainly some pretty unhappy couples.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see if more of those come up. And certainly, the State Board of Education is different than the one that voted on the plan that created all these forced mergers. So it's possible that they would find a more receptive audience, but I haven't heard about that.
Mm-hmm,
I haven't heard that about that as a wider trend. I think people's attentions are being focused to other fights, and other conversations.
Right. Well, let's talk about a couple of the other conversations going on in education in Vermont. You hang out at the State House a lot, following the House and Senate Education Committees, et cetera, and I guess to some extent the Finance Committees, because obviously, once again, money is always a key. It kind of walks right along in these conversations with the whole questions about how do we run our schools. And what are some of the conversations happening right now at the State House that are going to possibly have big effects on education in the next couple of years?
Yeah, so I think there have been two really big conversations happening over at the State House. And one thing that's interesting about them is they're big and impactful, but we're actually probably not going to see any particularly momentous legislation around these issues coming out this session. And what lawmakers seem to be doing is kind of like laying the foundation for the next biennium.
Mm-hmm.
To have really big debates about what to do about kind of two huge structural issues in Vermont education. One is infrastructure, like the literal built infrastructure of our schools,
mm-hmm.
which is very uneven, getting quite old in a lot of places. And, you know, that's why we have a spate of school bonds on the ballot. And you know, the bonds that we're going to see this week are basically the tip of the iceberg. So we're talking about school infrastructure, and the other thing that we're talking about at the State House is the formula that calculates your local property taxes, your education taxes. And that's mm-hmm. because there was this really big report that came out that was commissioned by the legislature at the beginning of early January, that basically said that the way that we have been doing that and the way that we count pupils, because remember, your local property taxes, education taxes, aren't tied to how much you're, you know, like whether or not your budget went up or down. They're tied to how much you spend per pupil. And that quote unquote pupil is this abstraction. It's not like a simple head count. And so the big question is, how do we count pupils?
Yep.
How do we decide how cost efficient or not your school district is, and therefore how high or low your taxes have to be? Because remember, in Vermont, the state doesn't decide how much you spend on your school. You do. But there are tax consequences to that, and that's determined by how low or high your per pupil spending is. So this big report came out, this long-awaited report, that said basically the way we calculate that, the way we decide, we calculate how much you have been spending per pupil and therefore how high or low your taxes off are, is kind of completely unconnected to what we know about how expensive it is to teach certain types of kids,
mm-hmm.
right? There is this understanding in education that certain types of kids are going to take more resources, they're going to take more supports, and therefore they're going to be more expensive, and that we should take that into account when we calculate things like taxes. And what this report said, they're like, many elements to it, but I think if anyone was going to take one big headline out of it, it's that we have been undercounting, undervaluing significantly how much more expensive and how much harder it is to educate kids who are in poverty.
Yeah, and kids who are learning English as a second language is another – that's another high-cost kid, basically.
That's another one that the report says you know, we have been undervaluing. So basically this report, if I'm going to really oversimplify it, mm-hmm. is saying that we have been overtaxing high poverty districts, districts with high numbers of ELL students.
English language learner, right?
English language learners.
Yep. I occasionally have to translate the EduBabble acronyms here.
Thank you. I appreciate
okay,
it.
No problem.
So – overtaxing those kinds of districts and undertaxing more wealthy districts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so the implications of this report, if we were actually just to kind of put them into place overnight, would create kind of wild swings in the tax rate.
In various communities.
Yeah, I mean, some places wouldn't see much change. But on the extreme, and I'm saying on the extreme ends of the spectrum, we're talking like 50-cent swings in
that's
either direction.
A lot. Yes, indeed.
So obviously, lawmakers have
that, of course, is 50 cents per $100 of value on the piece of property. So a $100,000 property works out to $500, I think.
I think way more.
Really?
Okay. You know what?
5,000?
We should figure this out during commercial
break. Yeah, okay, yeah. We'll do the math.
We'll do the math.
We're talking education here, and I guess neither of us got a math degree as part of our education.
No.
So, hey, let's bring in a caller real quickly here. Rama from Williamstown is on the line. And Rama, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, listen, with this whole education, the mergers, because it all's revolving around the money right now with this issue on Vermont education. there are three numbers that have to be dealt with at the statewide level, and that's the infrastructure, the physical infrastructure, the number of employees in the school, and the numbers of students. And out of the three numbers, the one that's been going down has been the number of students. And if you look at a graph, it kind of levels, it's kind of level out for the numbers of teachers and employees, and it's stayed level for the physical infrastructure up until very recently. And while the numbers, that describing the numbers that are important is easy to do, the answers are very complex in how to deal with those numbers. And the unfortunate side is, though, one way to simplify how to deal with the issues is either to centralize everything or really decentralize and empower your local school districts. Unfortunately, the state's going for the centralization point when it comes to control, but then they leave the responsibility and who the public looks at as being the local school boards. You know, so we have this dichotomy going on where the state wants to take over more authority without being answerable. They want to keep saying it's up to the school board. So I mention this because I hope people don't take it out on the school board. School boards are dealing with very few tools that they have in their toolbox to deal with the economics. And it is an unfortunate reality that unless people have made some real long-term studies as to what they could do in the local area, that closing schools, if you're within, you know, 10 or 15, 20 miles of another school, it starts to make some economic sense to a lot of people. But, you know, it just shouldn't be held against the school boards because this is an issue that's been pushed on them.
Rama, you are now part of the Payne Mountain School District, right, which is Williamstown and Northfield, I believe?
Correct.
And is there any talk of closing schools in that area?
Well, no, because... And now, because I co-chaired the merger study committee, and I was on the Williamstown School Board for a while and on the Payne Mountain Board for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And part of our, the whole thing that we did when we moved forward was the acknowledgement that we had no room to close any schools, because if we closed any one of our schools, we never had enough physical space to put the other students. So that question was not, you know, really a big one for us. But what we did do, conversely, is we put in a very heavy emphasis that we wanted to keep the separate buildings open, whether we had to close them or not. We wanted them open. We wanted the separate local cultures to be kept inside the schools as much as possible, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So the big new expense is tire chains for the buses to get over that mountain between Williamstown and Northfield, right?
Well, I mean, that could be it. But I'll tell you is we were able to find enough savings. A lot of money's been able to be put into educational programs that was being spent elsewhere. So, but I just really think that school boards are getting the unfair brunt of this because the decisions that they're making are the limited toolbox that they have to deal with what the state's telling them they have to do, essentially. So, you know, as we move forward, the state's answer and the legislature and the administration's answer is going to be, you know, gee, let's simplify it by centralizing stuff. That way fewer people have to make decisions. And I know Dan French, for instance, is in love with that concept. And I think he's a nice guy. He's a smart guy. He's wrongheaded on this. On the other hand, you could go the other way and say, well, listen, let's really empower the local school districts to handle this issue and to start passing laws that empower school districts again, as opposed to empowering the State Department of Education.
Well, I'm curious, what are the kinds of powers that you think local school districts should have?
Well, I think there's things like the graduation requirements. I think there should be more say-so as far as standardized testing and what testing needs to go on. I think
that's the federal government.
Well, it's not entirely, it isn't. But it is to some degree, but it's things which can be decided at a more local level that are right now being decided by AOE here in Vermont. There's also the issues around the state, for instance, keeps pushing people to, you know, let's send more kids to the career technical centers now, what they call CTECs, used to be called voc ed schools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like this where if they would let the school districts work on it, we could have come up with some very sensible solutions. But as it is right now, school districts are stuck with dealing with spending money to send students to places where the school districts held responsible for the student being at a totally different school. Whereas the school district probably could supply a lot, you know, supply those meet the student needs closer to home without all the traveling and being able to actually take some responsibility. There's a whole, and let's get into the labor relations things. I will tell you right now, I've listened to the legislature enough. They are actively hostile to school boards. Now, they say they're not, but they are. Every decision they make makes negotiating contracts, makes relations with employees more difficult for a school board or the administration. So there's, I'm not prepared to go through a whole list in detail if you wanted.
That's good, because we got to go to a bottom of the hour break very shortly, Rama. And I do appreciate you sort of stating the school board view here. I think that is important. We're going to be hearing from a parent. I think there's some parents out there who feel like they have a tough time getting boards to listen. And I hear you're saying boards are really squeezed and don't have much power or flexibility. And so these are important points, and I appreciate you making them, Rama. Thank you for the call. We are going to need to go to a bottom of the hour break here for some CBS News, and we'll be back shortly, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra, long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks, from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We're back with Lola Duffert, education writer for vtdigger.org, and talking about sort of the first full year of town meeting season following the implementation of Act 46, the school merger law in Vermont. A lot of communities are grappling with kind of the aftermath of this law passing in the state, and many, many districts around the state being reorganized into merged school districts, and what that means for the future of education in Vermont. We've got another person now on the telephone. Joanna Doria from Ripton is a parent of young kids who are going to be in the public schools, I do believe, in the Middlebury area. It's the Addison Central Supervisory Union in the coming years.
Well, and, now district post-Act 46.
Now district post-Act 46. Thank you, Lola. And Joanna Doria is on the phone, I believe. Good morning, Joanna.
Good morning. Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me on the show. Hi, Lola.
Thank you.
Hey.
Joanna, before we get to some of the issues we want to talk about with you, I wanted to ask Lola very briefly, just because it's still hanging over from the first half hour here, to talk a little bit about some of the bonding, the big infrastructure, big ticket items going on in the districts around the state. I mean, I guess South Burlington kind of leads the parade here with a $210 million proposal for an entirely new middle school, new high school, and new athletic center to be built on the campus, the existing campus on Dorset Street there in South Burlington. But there's some other projects nowhere near as large in scale or cost around the state. Are we entering a new age of school construction in Vermont, Lola?
We absolutely are. So this kind of town meeting is the tip of the iceberg in terms of bonding. You could also look to the bonds that were approved in Chittenden County last year, so Burlington and Winooski. But this week, there's a $60 million bond down in Slate Valley, which is the Fairhaven district.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a bunch of...
What would that pay for, do you know?
I believe it's big renovations to the high school and then a few other things in some of their other schools. But I think the bulk of the money is at the high school.
And you know, initially I look at these headlines and read some of the stories in Digger, for instance, and I go, we're in an age when the student population is declining. Why are we building schools? And I guess it's just schools get pretty used.
The schools are old. The problem is we have not had – so the most recent wave of school construction in Vermont was in the 90s when we had a population boom. So our newest buildings – the newest buildings in the state date back to the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the high schools, most of the union high schools, so Fairhaven, for example, date back to the 50s and 60s. And, of course, we have a whole bunch of schools that are like you know, in 19th century buildings that were, you know, that are from like 1856 or whatever. So we have very old buildings in Vermont with a lot of deferred maintenance needs. And on top of that, there was a moratorium put on our school construction aid program back in, I believe, 2009, you know, right around the recession.
This is at the state level.
Yeah. So school districts have been kind of putting off a lot of capital infrastructure investments. Which means you have a lot of deferred maintenance needs. So a lot of problems got worse in those 10 years because they weren't attended to because schools felt like, well, we want to wait until, you know, that moratorium is lifted. So we have an extraordinary amount of pent up need. And so we're going to see, I mean, a tsunami of requests probably coming forward.
Now, has the moratorium been lifted, or are there prospects for that happening, or where
no.
are we on that?
So it has not been lifted, and it almost certainly will not be lifted. So the legislature has been taking a lot of testimony on school infrastructure needs because at this point, you know, based on a survey that the Superintendents Association did, we are looking at well over half a billion in school construction bonds coming before voters between now and 2023.
Wow.
So if we do nothing, if the state does nothing, we're going to see about half a billion in school bonds likely more, put before voters, likely greenlit, and that's paid out of the education fund.
Greenlit, what does that mean?
So approved.
Uh-huh.
Right. So if voters approve these bonds, and a good number of them are likely to, we're going to see this whole new, really big cost pressure come into the education fund. That's in addition to all the other cost pressures that we already have.
Yeah.
So lawmakers are trying to figure out, like, well, what do we do about this? And on top of that, there's this concern that, you know, certain types of districts are more likely to approve big bonds. It has, like, escaped nobody's attention that South Burlington has the biggest bond and is also kind of one of the wealthier districts in the state.
Right, yeah.
Meanwhile, you know, I've talked to superintendents in much more rural, much poorer areas that have, you know, gone before their voters with much smaller requests and, you know, to address like really extraordinarily dire infrastructure needs who keep getting turned down because their local communities are extremely tax averse and concerned about affordability. And so there's a lot of concern at the state level that if we do nothing, A, we're going to see costs increase a lot in a lot of cases for, you know, because there's very real pent-up need to address some really important structural problems with our schools, and B, that the money might not be always distributed where the need is highest.
One thing I'm not understanding here, which is that you mentioned a lot of pressure on the Ed Fund, which is a state pot of money that goes out to local school districts to help pay for schools. Meanwhile, on the other hand, we have this moratorium for support for school construction. So how is it that we're actually – I mean, it sounds like if we have a moratorium at the state level on school construction, we're going to end up with local communities, you know, individual towns, taxpayers being asked to pick up the entire cost of these bond issues.
So that's not how it works at all. So the state aid program that we used to have – would help subsidize school building projects out of the capital bill.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that's just general fund funds.
Okay.
So that's just money that doesn't impact property taxes. Either way, whichever way you look at it, it's all state money.
Okay.
But the way that we do it now without the capital construction, without the a formal school building aid program, with school districts just going out and bonding. It has nothing to do with the way a municipal bond would work.
Okay.
So it is basically the same as increasing your general budget because a school bond, that debt service is paid out of your general budget as a school district, and almost all of a school district, local school district's budget is paid out from the education fund.
Yeah.
So that means that while, and also your remember, your spending per pupil is what determines your local tax rate.
Mm-hmm.
So South Burlington's bond is going to increase their per pupil spending. So their taxes are going to go way up if they approve this bond. They're going to feel it more directly. But that bond is going to put upward pressure everywhere. Everyone's school bond puts upward pressure on property taxes everywhere.
Okay, so the moratorium really was on the state using capital construction bonded money itself. And bonding is simply a way of borrowing money.
No, it just it's where is the debt service being paid out from?
Yeah. Right.
So we're talking about bonding in either case.
A sort of local bond issue or this capital construction method. But if it's the local bond issue, it's going to come out of the Ed Fund, which effectively, I see what you mean, is paying off a bond issue from the Ed Fund instead of from the capital.
The capital bill, yeah, okay. Right. Either way, it's state money, but what you're really talking about is what kind of taxes are you using to pay?
Got it. Okay. Hey, well, I do want to bring in Joanna Doria here. You are from Ripton. You have a couple of young kids who, am I right in assuming that you're expecting they're going to be attending the public schools in the Addison Central Supervisor Union in the coming years?
Yes. So I have a 2.5-year-old, but I also have a 5-year-old who's now in the school system at our local elementary school. And this is her first year. I wanted to respond a little bit to this. I won't pretend to know as much as you do, Lola, about the bonding and that statewide funding system that's super complex. But I do want to relate it to my district in that the investment of bricks and mortar and talking about, you know, new facilities, brand new, and our board has recently hired an architect to lead this conversation that we're having now in terms of consolidation and what that looks like for us. And I will say Ripton was built in 89. It's not in dire need of a lot of work. We have solar panels and a new roof. And so it seems to me like the conversation, I'd rather be having a conversation about investing in new facilities at the high school level. I don't think that our youngest kids need that shiny stuff. They need place-based learning, and they need, an environment. And the tradition in our school district has been to invest in educators and not facilities. And that's sort of why some of our local elementary schools are in the state that they are in and needing some, you know, in terms of asbestos mitigation and some health and safety stuff. So I just wanted to respond to that.
Okay, I appreciate that. Give us an overall preview of what's on the ballot in the Addison Central towns tomorrow. Are there any bond issues? Are there specific proposals to close schools yet, or is that still kind of in the wind but not on paper yet? Or where are we overall?
Yeah, definitely not on paper yet. There were last spring the board put forth some proposals. All of those scenarios included closing at least one school.
Mm-hmm.
If there's been some evolution from those community engagement, those meetings, but it's still, like I said, an architect is now the one that they're using as their expertise to drive this consolidation conversation. And so there are no bond issues on the ballot tomorrow, but there are, we petitioned the school board to warn some changes in our articles of agreement. One, the way the school board members are voted for right now, it's at large, and I understand the constitutionality of the way it had to be set up that way, but we're kind of a unique school district in that Middlebury is so much bigger, that our anchor town is so much bigger than the surrounding smaller towns that they carry all the power in terms of that vote. And the second petition had to do with a town vote before school closure. And it's my understanding that most of the merged districts in the state have that as part of their articles of agreement. I think only 8 don't and 38 do. So they rejected it. And we were able to, along with petitioning the board, we also brought it forth town select boards to put it on the ballot, and five of the seven towns, one town decided to put it as more of a survey, but four towns, they'll see it as a referendum, not a binding vote, but something, hopefully, that the board can use, some information that the board can use in terms of taking public input. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing more powerful than a vote. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be, that's big for us tomorrow. We also, two new school board members have surfaced in this whole process, and I believe in their candidacy, Ellie Bishop and Kristen Gardner. Ellie lives in Salisbury and Kristen lives in Middlebury, and I think they would be a great addition to the school board and the valuable work that the school board has already done. I do appreciate the difficult position that these boards are in terms of consolidation. The biggest thing I've felt is the consolidation of power in our district and how they carry all the power. And
that's a 13-member board, I think you told me?
13-member board, yep.
Yeah.
Seven from Middlebury and then one member from all the outlying towns.
Wow, and again, the outlying towns are Ripton, Shoreham. What else on the list?
Yeah, so Ripton, Shoreham, Cornwall, Bridport, Weybridge, and Salisbury.
Right, and I mean, actually, Lola, maybe you can fill us in on this, but I'm not sure that's really that unique in Vermont in terms of having one town be kind of central to a region. I think of, for instance, the Wyndham district that includes Brattleboro. You're going to have Brattleboro and then several right. smaller outlying towns, you know, St. Johnsbury, and then the small towns of like Concord and Peacham and so on surrounding that. There are other places around the state, but that's just the sort of the way settlement patterns have happened, haven't they?
Right. Well, I mean, it's also been a running theme in anxiety around consolidation, right, is the bigger town having way more power on a consolidated board.
And it, if you were to redraw this map, Joanna Doria, and try to figure out a way, excuse me, not to have that be as big an issue in your district, how would you structure it?
Well, I think, to me, it's about the process right now. And focusing on one solution isn't where we're at, and that's what I feel like the board is. I mean, they do entertain. They are a March 10th. They are going to bring forth the proposal by Truex Collins, which is the architect firm that's working with our district. I think, to me, I want to draw attention to the process and about the conversations. I haven't heard about the value of our diverse small towns and what that adds to a school district. And I think in ACSD we're doing a lot of great things. I mean, we're doing a lot of good things that are that are benefiting our kids, and to not have that as part of the conversation and not feel validated in that is the hardest part. I think there are creative solutions. I think there might be, I don't know in terms of the board makeup if there's anything that can be done, but in terms of maintaining some of the quality programs in the schools that we have, maybe a reconfiguration within our district. And what I'm feeling now is some of the issues that are happening maybe in the Middlebury school, their specific elementary school, it's almost like they think it's the rural town's fault almost, because we're, in their minds, taking all the resources. And that's just not true. And that's creating, all-time high tensions between towns. And that's not healthy because, all of our kids go to the same middle school and the high school, and that's not healthy. That's not where anybody wants to be.
Yeah, that's an important factor I would expect that local residents would want to keep in mind as they sort of think about any kind of a tug of war between large town elementary school and small town elementary school in the same district. Are you seeing these kinds of tensions pop up elsewhere around the state, Lola?
Yeah, and I'm also seeing larger towns feel like smaller smaller schools and smaller communities are being kind of unreasonably subsidized, right? That that those districts, specifically what Joanna said about the way that you know, Middlebury feels about maybe Ripton. For example, in Harwood, more than one school board member has pointed out that the school district, the elementary school that was slated for closure, was also the wealthiest one, right? With very, very tiny teacher to student ratios.
Yeah.
And they were saying maybe that's not where we should be spending most of our resources. And maybe in order to kind of make the whole stronger, like you said, we need to do some pruning. There is this dynamic of like, of this feeling like towns are being pitted against each other. And I think there's a sense in which, since we are talking about a finite number of resources, whatever decision gets taken, it's going to be painful for at least one community. It's very clear to me, you know, from as an outside observer, that there is no creative solution that's going to make all sides feel good about the situation. Because what we're looking at is a system that's under increasing cost pressures, a lot of which are outside any actor's control, like healthcare, like capital needs, with fewer and fewer kids.
Well, we've been mentioning the Harwood district repeatedly. Of course, Waterbury is located in that district. We have a caller out on the line right now who is also from that district. Nils from Duxbury is calling in. Good morning, Nils.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. it seems to me that the belt tightening, it's obvious that we have to do this. What I haven't heard any conversation about is, who are the players in the system? Well, we have the state, we have state funding, we have parents and residents, we have kids in declining numbers, and we have school administrations, then we have the teachers' union and the teachers, and then we have the healthcare mess.
And don't forget the school boards. I don't think you've
can somebody well on your list yet. I don't want to get started on the school board, because some point I would ask, if you're on the school board, are you advocating for the kids or are you advocating for the teachers? And the reason I say that is a conversation that you had with Christine Sullivan a while back, and I asked her a question about that, and she completely dodged the question. It was a very smart political response. It was absolutely...
Let me ask Lola Dufford.
But the question I have is, have all of those people contributed? I'm going to have to contribute. You're going to have to contribute. Mm-hmm. Wherever you live, you're going to pay more. Has the teachers' union said, okay, look, we're going to do this, this, and this in order to slim our part of the pie? Has that happened? And I don't have to stay on the phone to hear your response.
Okay, thanks for the call, Nils. I appreciate it. Lola Duffert, you hear from the NEA folks a lot that what's good for the teachers is good for the students because it's good for the overall educational system. What about this tension that Nils seems to point to, that what's good for the teachers may not be good for the students? Is that a common theme out there that you're hearing?
Sure. I mean, people love to blame the union and labor costs in general, because that's where we put most of our money in education, right? So that is a common complaint. I would point out that, teachers have seen their benefits, especially when it comes to healthcare, eroded at the same time, and they've seen a lot of layoffs. So it's not like there hasn't been some belt tightening on the labor side as well. A few years ago, for example, we saw teachers go to much lower premium, higher out of pocket cost
on their healthcare.
On their healthcare, yeah. Exactly. So,
Joanna Doria, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, do you feel like that there is uneven pain taking here?
I'm not sure I totally understand the question. Like, the burden of tightening the budget needs to be carried by more people, including the union. Is that what you're...
Yeah, pretty much.
It's hard for me to say. I am just a parent that really appreciates the teachers that my daughter has in her school.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, there are other companies that if if they go on a pay freeze, if things aren't doing well, and that, I don't know if that makes sense with the school district, but that's something that happens, you know, in my husband's company. And it's like, if they're not doing, if the resource, if they're not performing, then, so I don't know. I don't know what it looks like. I do think the healthcare piece is a big, I mean, our budget went up 13% just with healthcare costs. And if that continues to rise, there's nothing. What I'm scared is might happen is closing schools, thinking like you were saying about pruning and not saving any money. So you go ahead and I don't know if there's some. I know that there's been some spending freezes in other districts even after closing schools, and I just don't want that to be our case. And just to talk about that metaphor again, I think of our elementary schools as the roots, and Ripton is not it. It's the highest it's ever been. I mean, the school was not designed to hold 150 kids. It was designed to hold, you know, 60 to 70 kids, and we're at 55 right now. So it's not like we are feeling that declining enrollment. You know, in the high school, there is a bubble, and once those kids graduate, we're going to feel those numbers drop at the high school level, and then with that weighting per pupil, that's the most money at that high school level. So I can appreciate that, but if we can think of our elementary schools as the roots, and not about pruning to keep the whole, the health of the organism, then
that's where I'm interesting, you know, take on the metaphor, I think, actually. That's pretty good. Good response to the whole plant thing. I think that, I mean, it's just amazing to me that there are so many different pressures here on the overall idea of educating our kids. Obviously, I think most Vermonters feel like it's an important thing, and certainly it's something that shows up in our property taxes. This has been, I think, a really interesting and excellent discussion. The two of you, I really appreciate you joining me. Joanna Doria from Ripton this morning, and Lola Duffert, education reporter.
Unity and Transparency, if you want to visit their Facebook page.
Okay. Lola Duffert from VTDigger.org, thank you very much for coming in this morning to talk
about
this.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to go to a top of the hour break for some CBS News and change the focus afterward to Super Tuesday. We'll be back.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back, and I want to mention once again, we have some really solid coverage, I think, coming up tomorrow evening on Town Meeting Day, Super Tuesday. We are going to be from about 8:30 to 10 p.m. here on WDEV, FM, and AM. We'll have Lee Cattell, Joel Nashman, and Dylan Deloge with election results throughout our listening area, town meeting occurrences, etc. And we'll also be going to our partners at CBS News Radio for coverage of Super Tuesday results. And so it'll be a good full dose of coverage here from WDEV, FM, and AM. And speaking of our CBS News partners, we have Stephen Portnoy on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Stephen.
Hey, good morning to you.
Thank you for joining me. I want to just get into Super Tuesday right off the bat. Obviously, the landscape has changed even in the past couple of days now with the big Biden win on Saturday and Pete Buttigieg dropping out yesterday. And I'm wondering, what's the read out there in terms of how that will affect the remaining candidates in the race? Are most of the moderate voters that might have been backing Buttigieg going to go to Biden, or are they maybe looking at Klobuchar and others, possibly even Bernie Sanders? What do you think? What's going to happen?
Or maybe Elizabeth Warren. Look, voters will tell us by this time Wednesday morning. We'll be able to discuss the aftermath. But you know, your state and 13 others will have the opportunity to weigh in tomorrow in what is the closest thing to a national primary we're going to get in this cycle. More than 1,340 delegates up for grabs. And, you know, the obvious conventional wisdom in politics this morning is with the departure of Pete Buttigieg, the likelihood is that people who were supporting him will go to a like-minded moderate. Now, Buttigieg has not made an endorsement yet, and there's a report in the New York Times that he spoke last night to Joe Biden. We had heard that they were essentially playing phone tag and had been trading voicemails. But Buttigieg, in his speech last night, without endorsing anyone, did call for unity, to get behind a candidate who can win, and he essentially implicitly criticized and continued to criticize Bernie Sanders and the Sanders movement, talking about the need to unify with an optimistic vision for the future that does not require adherence to a particular ideology. And that seemed to observers to be a criticism of Sanders' movement and, frankly, Sanders' supporters. The idea that you have to be ideologically pure, and it's not merely what it is you are proposing in terms of policy, but perhaps your background, your career history, the donors to your campaign. These are things that Bernie Sanders criticized Pete Buttigieg for, and he is offering criticism back to say, hey, look, these are the things I stand for, these are the things I would implement, and it, just because of X, Y, or Z, it shouldn't disqualify any good person from running. That's the dynamic going into Super Tuesday, but we don't know. You know, there are polls that indicate that Bernie Sanders is likely to win not just your state, but also perhaps California, which is the biggest state in play. He's expected to do well in Texas. What he's been able to do is build a broad-based coalition of young people across demographics. So you're going to see young people of color, young white voters. Pretty much anyone under the age of 45 is inclined to support Bernie Sanders. Now, over the age of 45, that's where the exit polls to date have shown that Bernie Sanders has a very significant difficulty cutting through, and Joe Biden is the preferred candidate, increasingly, of older voters.
Yeah, that is really interesting. One thing about this critique of the of worrying about the down ballot races, you know, we had a moderate Democrat in the White House for 8 years in Barack Obama, and he did not do a wonderful job in picking up congressional seats, as I recall. So I'm not sure. I mean, doesn't having a moderate nominee, even a president, necessarily mean success in the House and Senate? I'm just not sure about that. Do you have any thoughts there?
It's an interesting question. You know, Barack Obama enjoyed not just a majority, but a supermajority at a certain point in the Senate in the first 2 years of his term. But then when they started to get into the policy, that's when the Republicans really were on the march with the Tea Party in the aftermath of the economic downturn. And that's where he really lost ground. And in every election thereafter, he continued to lose ground. And it's, you know, you make an interesting point about the idea that Bernie Sanders, one thing he does enjoy, is a tremendous enthusiasm in his base. People who are incredibly enthusiastic and willing to do what it takes to get their candidate elected. Now, the challenge that you're going to hear expressed is the idea of keeping and holding that majority, because so many of the Democrats who make up the coalition that is governing in the House of Representatives is made up of people who hail from places where progressive politics are not as popular as they might be in other parts of the country.
Yeah. Stephen Portnoy, thanks so much for joining me this morning. I really appreciate it. It's always good to talk with you. I want to continue on our conversation this morning about the Super Tuesday primary happening in 14 states. It's really the first and I guess maybe only thing that approaches a national primary. Some folks have talked about that we should do a national primary period and get all the states on the same day to decide to winnow out the field for candidates in the political parties for president of the United States. But the closest thing we have is Super Tuesday, when 14 states happen to coincide, and including Vermont. So tomorrow, folks are urged to go out and take a ballot, either the Republican or Democratic ballot, and pick your candidate of choice. Maybe you want to get in there and cast a vote for President Trump because you feel like he's been doing a good job in running the country for the past 3.5 years. The Democrats are obviously offering up a range of options, although a range that's narrowed a bit. No more Pete Buttigieg, for instance, and Tom Steyer's out of the picture now, too. So there we go. Wanted to bring in someone who's watching all of this quite carefully, a political science professor from St. Michael's College in Colchester, Patricia Ciplon, and I believe she's on the phone with us right now. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining me. I'm interested, you know, we talked the other day a little bit about the overall process here of this primary season, particularly in the Democratic Party. Obviously, the ground has changed a bit since our conversation. Joe Biden scoring that really big victory in South Carolina on Saturday, and then Pete Buttigieg deciding he was going to throw in the towel as of yesterday. What are your thoughts on the impact on the remaining candidates those two occurrences might have?
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time?
Sure. What impact on the remaining candidates in the Democratic primary contest now will the departure of Pete Buttigieg have, and what impact on them will the big win for Joe Biden on Saturday have?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think everybody's guessing right now what Pete Buttigieg's next move is, and he has 26 delegates that he's already earned, and if he endorses somebody, he can tell his delegates that this is who they should support. So that's one piece.
And are they locked into that if he tells them that?
Well, no, they're. It is extremely, extremely likely that that they will do the thing he asked them to do.
Okay.
There's a couple of states, Nevada is one of them, and I can't remember if Buttigieg has. I think he might have three delegates. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if he got a couple of delegates in Nevada. That you are pledged to the person you are pledged to going in, But generally, if somebody has delegates and they endorse somebody else, the delegates go to that new person.
Okay, yeah, so makes sense.
So that's one question. If he were to do that, then that would actually move Biden ahead of Bernie.
Is that because the margin between them now is fewer than 26?
Yes.
Oh, so, I didn't realize it was that close. Wow.
I'm looking right now, and it looks like the delegate tracker I'm looking at, the margin's only 7.
Okay.
So yes, that could. And again, I mean, the thing to remember going into Super Tuesday is that less than 4% of the delegates have been pledged. But we really, really magnify that, obviously. And, you know, everybody's projecting like crazy off of four states.
I know.
So it would obviously give Biden a psychological edge and a media edge if that were to happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that's one of the huge speculations. Another is simply, and where are Buttigieg's supporters themselves going to go? Obviously, if Biden gets Buttigieg's endorsement, then that could make a big difference in terms of how people are going to be voting on Super Tuesday. Although there's a lot of other. There's polling suggesting that Bernie is actually the number two choice for a lot of Buttigieg supporters. But then again, Warren also does well as a second choice for Buttigieg. So
that surprises me a little bit. And tell me how this would work in a voter's mind if you have a good guess at it. Let's say I'm a moderate voter, and I really, you know, I prefer Pete Buttigieg, or I think, you know, he's my candidate, and he drops out of the race, and now I'm looking for a second choice. As a moderate voter, I might be attracted to Joe Biden or Amy Klobuchar.
True, but I think that there's sort of two axes that people are pivoting or moving around right now, and one is how liberal their beliefs are. So whether your policy goals and your ideals are more in the progressive camp or more in the moderate camp, and then there's a second that is this narrative that's all about a certain view of, I guess you could call it, competence and who is positioned to actually play the policy game. Mm-hmm. And I think that from the ideological perspective, of course, Buttigieg is more centrist and Warren's more progressive. But from that narrative around who who could maneuver better in terms of creating coalitions and trading votes and all those kinds of things. I think Buttigieg and Warren both put out there that they were skilled in that kind of way. And I think that for the that what I'm calling, for lack of a better word, competency constituency.
Yeah, or another word might be leadership, right?
Well, I guess leadership. Again, I think there are different kinds of leadership. There's no question that that in the inspirational form of leadership, Bernie's way up there.
Yeah, no, but, I get that. I mean, I guess just in terms of organizational, I mean, maybe I'm casting this a little bit incorrectly, but I think that there are some skills here which people, I mean, in 2016, a lot of Trump supporters were going around saying that they thought that as a business person, Trump had some skills that would be translatable to running a government, basically. And whether that has panned out or not is a question maybe for another day. But there is this question about as you were describing, the ability to work with coalitions and to kind of get things done and all of that sort of thing. And that may be some of where that sounds like what you're talking about in terms of some of the points going to, I don't know, let me ask about another person who's just arriving on the scene in some ways, and that's Mike Bloomberg. Is he going to have an impact on Super Tuesday?
Wow, I wish I had a crystal ball. My honest gut is a lot less than, definitely a lot less than I thought a week ago. I think... Mm-hmm.
A lot less than he paid for?
certainly a lot less than he paid for.
Yeah.
I think that... and obviously, Vermont is not representative of the country, but I think that there's... A lot of people who really don't feel okay about what they perceive is happening. There's a basic maxim that has always been that all other things being equal, you go with name recognition, and he's pushing that so hard, he's shoving it. He's just simply blanketing everything everywhere with his name, and I think that there's a little more of a backlash than I expected about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are sort of seeing it as not super, well, certainly not genuine, not about engagement in the way that everybody else has been engaged.
Yeah, I mean, I see his ads now, and I kind of go, okay, Bloomer, you know. Okay, boomer thing, I sort of feel like the country has been a little overdosed with Michael Bloomberg, haven't we? Or
I think I look and I just sort of see people kind of rolling their eyes at just how much they've been blanketed.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting little political science, I'm glad I'm talking to a political science professor about this, maybe experiment going on where basically somebody's kind of raison d'etre is really just all advertising. I mean, Bloomberg, I mean, yeah, he had his stint as mayor of New York, but in terms of, you know, what he's offering the country, he hasn't really, I don't think, you know, been that strong on just being a participant in the debates in terms of carving out positions. He hasn't been in the game that long, so maybe that's part of it. But I sort of feel like, you know, this is the, if you wanted to run a test to say if a candidate's entire strategy was just dumping a ton of money into ads, how would that work? I think we're about to see, right?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I also think that that the other thing that that the country is seeing, and I think that sometimes some of the political analysts are having a hard time with it,
mm-hmm.
Because we don't spend as much time talking about it or seeing it in this country, is that Bernie Sanders, he's the antithesis of Bloomberg in a number of ways, and one of them is he has spent the last 3 years organizing like crazy. And his brand of organizing, you know, he's taken tons of heat. Is he a real Democrat? You know, what does he do with the Democratic Party? But he views the Democratic Party more broadly, I think, than a lot of other people, and he views it as in a New Deal kind of way, as a coalition of working class organizations. And so, you know, it's not a coincidence at all that, like, in Nevada, he did really, really well with organized unions, including ones where the leadership was not as interested in him as a candidate, but the people in the union, the union members were. And mm-hmm. and that's not because they heard about him in, you know, the last few weeks before the election. It's because Sanders people have been on the ground working with unions for a really long time.
What do they actually do in that organizational work that we talk about now? I mean, are they going to meetings? Are they trying to come out and hear about Bernie Sanders, or what's the?
I think part of it, yes, but I think the other thing is that there's a huge amount of outreach, and there has been for forever, between Sanders and the kinds of groups that support working issues that sometimes are allied with unions and sometimes are unions themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Bernie talks about in his speeches the fact that he was down in Florida working with Immokalee workers before anybody else had heard of Immokalee, Florida. Mm-hmm. And one of the union groups that loves Bernie, has been working with Bernie for years, is the National Nurses Union. And NNU is one of the really big sort of foot soldier groups in pushing forward Medicare for All. And so that's the other piece of it, is that it's working with them on their issues also. So supporting union strikes, supporting specific issues and health care for all with the progressive union organizations. Like, some of the unions are nervous about it because it takes away one of their bargaining chips with employers, but some of the unions, especially some of the unions with lowest paid workers, are really interested literally in for everybody, like for their families and for everybody else too.
Yeah.
And so it's about working on these issues also. And
I think if you're a labor activist and you look at kind of the last 20 years of labor history in the United States, you realize that unions have been so heavily under attack and frankly on the wane in terms of membership and so on, you've got to see that your position of bargaining for healthcare may be weakening, frankly. Mm-hmm. Does that bring people around to think, maybe I need something bigger than the union to help ensure that I can see a doctor when I need one?
I think so. And the truth is, and middle class America is realizing this too, is that even knowing you have health care says very, very little about the quality of the coverage that you have. And the holes in that coverage are getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, that's a big part of the issue, I think, here, is that if people really look at this, they'll, you know, if somebody says that it comes along with a reasonable statement that we can bring about a universal healthcare system where copays and deductibles are a thing of the past, and, you know, you just went through a healthcare re-enrollment in which your copays and deductibles went up by a couple $1,000, you might give that a serious thought, I would think.
Yep.
Now, I'm wondering also whether Bernie Sanders can actually win let me put it this way. Suppose he gets 45% of the delegates going into the convention. The Democrats, you know, there are a lot of folks in the party who are saying, including the other candidates who were up on stage during that debate a week and a half ago, that doesn't do it for him. We need to have a brokered convention. And I get. Do you think that that's a real threat? Is that a real possibility out there?
Oh yes, I definitely think it is. I think it's a $64,000 question, and I think everybody's really, really sweating it. And I think that the scary part about it is that even if there is that kind of a face-off, one side is going to come away really, really angry. And I would expect that there would have to be sort of a papering over of it for the sake of the general election. But then we wind up in the same situation that we wound up in 2016, where people who supported whichever side comes away losing is much more half-hearted in their support in the general. And I think that's a really, really terrifying scenario, not just for the presidency, but also for Congress.
I want to talk more about that sort of scenario and its possible outcomes, depending on, of course, which way it goes. I mean, I think that the impacts might be different, but we need to go to a bottom of the hour break here for a little bit of CBS News and a couple words from our sponsors on the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV, and Professor Trish Ciplon of St. Michael's College. I hope you'll stay with me past the break, and we can talk some more and perhaps take some listener calls at 244-1777. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes, folks. And stay with us.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Continuing into the final half hour of this Monday morning broadcast here, I wanted to mention once more our coverage we're doing tomorrow night of town meeting, local elections, local ballot issues, and also a lot of coverage from CBS of the Super Tuesday results, which will be rolling in tomorrow evening from about 8:30 to 10. We're going to have some high school basketball on, but from about 8:30 to 10, WDEV's Lee Cattell, Joel Najman, and Dylan Deloge will have election results from throughout our listening area, and we will also join our partners at CBS News for coverage of the Super Tuesday results. Joining our coverage actually will be a full team of veteran Vermont journalists from their local areas checking in with us. We're going to be speaking with Steve Pappas from the Times Argus Rutland Herald, Tommy Gardner from the Star Reporter, Tom Brown from the Montpelier Bridge, John Flowers from the Addison Independent, Mike Donahue will have Chittenden County results, and much more, including the Bernie Sanders rally at the Champlain Valley Fairgrounds. Remember, Champlain Valley Expo is going to be the scene of a Bernie Sanders rally tomorrow evening, a rare Vermont appearance these days for our junior senator. He's been awfully busy traveling the country on the presidential hustings, and he's going to roll in a rally tomorrow evening here in Vermont. So I'm sure that'll draw a large crowd of local supporters here from the Green Mountain State. Wanted to continue our conversation now with Trish Ciplon. She is a professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Colchester, and one of her areas of study has been leftist political movements, if I understand your academic biography correctly, Professor Ciplon. And you were mentioning on the phone the other day that when we were talking about your appearance today, that Bernie Sanders is somebody who has something beyond what a lot of regular presidential candidates have, which is that he actually is trying to be the tribune of a social movement. Tell us more about that.
I think that one of the things that some people are missing in all of this discussion around who will eventually be president and can they effectively govern is that we've been in an era for a really long time where we view policymaking as the result of a lot of sort of horse trading on Capitol Hill and being propelled and pushed by special interests that are mostly, although not exclusively, economic. Occasionally there's ideological ones. Well, you can say the NRA is economic and ideological, since it mainly supports gun manufacturers. But anyway, the point being that it's being pushed by special interest, and it's a lot of insider baseball on Capitol Hill. And what Bernie is, his vision and what he's running on proposing to do is really different than that. It is true, and some people are excited about and some people fear, that he is talking about transformational change. But for that transformational change to happen, it won't happen through the mechanism of this sort of insider politicking that we're used to. What will happen is that there will be enormous amounts of groundswell support for the kinds of major reforms that he's talking about, and the people that are going to have to vote to support them, if he's successful, will be being pushed by their own constituencies, by their own people, massively calling them, pushing them, calling upon them, telling them that they're going to be taking them out of office if they don't support things like Medicare for All. And so it's just a completely radically different way of thinking about how are you going to get this, in some ways, heavy lift. It's not a heavy lift, and Bernie says this all the time, in terms of what the average American wants. Americans overwhelmingly do want radical change on our healthcare policy. It's a heavy lift in the way that we normally think about politics, which is getting it past the organized interests that oppose it. And so, his vision of doing that is mobilizing average people.
Yeah, and in recent elections, we have had this phenomenon where something like half the country or more doesn't vote. And Bernie Sanders promises that he's going to mobilize a lot of the folks who have been alienated to the extent where they don't bother going to the polls. The New York Times had a story about 10 days ago, I believe it was, looking at primary results so far and trying to see if there was any evidence to support this idea that suddenly you were going to mobilize folks who hadn't been traditionally voting. And the numbers in Iowa, the numbers in New Hampshire, the numbers even in Nevada so far were not really showing a big boost in turnout. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about that?
My biggest thought about that is that I think that is also a function of a broad level of political, it's about political disengagement, but it's also about sort of norms of the country. I think I'm astonished sometimes, even now, when I realize how few people simply don't go, don't turn out for primaries and caucuses to begin with. And mm-hmm. And I think that there's sort of a general vision in the United States, and it's pushed by all kinds of ways in all of our messaging. The way that people think about elections is the general election. And I don't think it's true that there has not been this enormous groundswell at the level of the primaries. And I think that that's a lot a function of people thinking that's stuff that political parties do, and I'm not into political parties. I don't think that is necessarily going to translate into there not being a big upswell in the general election. I also think that this mass mobilization that I'm talking about, I think, is sort of the way that it tends to work is sort of in a snowball kind of way. And so I don't know of as many people who are massively or that there are all of the organizing in place to be canvassing as as strongly as I think there will be in the general. And so I just think that it's sort of a creaky machine that is taking a little while to get rolling, but I think as it starts to roll, it's going to snowball. If Bernie is able to keep his momentum going forward, then
the big if is if he's the nominee, because it sounds like what you're talking about here, if he is the kind of social movement candidate, and the others are sort of the insider baseball candidates who are, you know, largely within the realm of the status quo. Now, Elizabeth Warren may be a second person who is, you know, seen as somewhat transformative, although I think on some of her individual positions, you know, certainly Bernie Sanders supporters question that. But if Sanders actually were to win the nomination, you're thinking that might wake up people who might still not show up if the nominee were Joe Biden or Amy Klobuchar, for instance.
Yes, I think the AOC phenomenon is the closest example to what I think. I think on a district level, that is that's sort of the model of if Bernie were to win, kind of what it would look like. Mm-hmm. It's you have this system that everybody is sort of used to, and an outcome that everybody's sort of used to, but underneath it, there was all of this organizing work, all of this campaigning, all of this very individual person to person, very much making people feel like they had a personal stake in it, and then all of these other people were shocked that this thing happened, but it didn't happen spontaneously. It happened because of all of this work that people, to a certain extent, weren't seeing, because it wasn't the work that people are used to seeing.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring in a listener. Fred's on the line from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. I'm wondering how future administrations are going to enforce their foreign policy. Right now, we have what they call proxy wars going on, and the major powers won't allow these proxy wars to get out of hand, because the major powers don't want to get into a conflict themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you think we're going to handle this situation? Can we do it just economically, or will we continue to use proxy wars?
Well, let me ask if Trish Siflon has any thoughts about that. Do you? It's a little bit off the topic of our immediate electoral prospects here, but this is future foreign policy, I guess, from Fred.
Well, I mean, I guess I would, I sort of feel like my first question is, or sort of reaction is to this idea that, well, the great powers don't let things get out of hand. And I feel like getting out of hand is partly about the perspective that you're looking at it from. I think that somebody in Syria, somebody in Yemen would say they're well out of hand.
Things are out of hand right now.
Things are very much out of hand.
The big powers don't want to go to war with each other. You know that.
Sure.
So what they're going to do, you know, it's out of hand, but it doesn't go to the effect where the United States is going to go to war with Russia because of MAD, and then a conventional war would be just as bad.
So, I mean, do you think that are you looking at the field of candidates, Fred, and you thinking that the outcome here will be vastly different depending on who gets elected?
No, I don't, because it's too important that these wars don't get out of hand. So what's going to happen is you're going to have an interesting phenomenon, which you're just considering now, and that's stability-instability paradox. That's what we have right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to continue, I think. I mean, it's the only logical reason right now I can think of. I mean, we can fight wars economically, and we're doing that now, but, you know, we just don't want to go to the conventional, because it could be too dangerous, but a proxy war wouldn't be as dangerous, because the two proxy countries wouldn't have nuclear weapons. And so the countries that have nuclear weapons wouldn't let it get out of hand.
All right, Fred. Well, I thank you for the call. Interesting observation. Trish Sliplon, I wanted to kind of return to the thread of the conversation that we were having about the idea of organizing enough voters here and the chances that that's going to happen. I mean, I have two questions right that come to mind immediately. One is, let's say you're a Democratic Party stalwart, you know, somebody who maybe even an elected official or just somebody who's, you know, been a donor to the Democratic Party, various candidates over the years. And you're looking at Bernie Sanders and you're hearing this promise that when Bernie Sanders gets the nomination, if he does, he is going to be able to suddenly bring out to the polls in November, you know, millions of people who have not voted in previously or not voted in, you know, 20 years or something, whatever the case may be. And tell me about the thought process that will bring somebody to or not to making that bet.
Well, I think the biggest thing that I would think about if I were a Democratic Party stalwart is I most worried about preserving the Democratic Party as it is right now, or am I worried about the future? Because I think if I were worried about the future, I would feel, well, I feel like my answer to that question would determine to a very large extent how comfortable I felt with Bernie, because I think it is true that if Bernie were to win, there are some fundamental changes that would likely happen with the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party gets a ton of money from the same people that the Republican Party does, for example. I think the flip side is that one of the things that I think is happening, I think that 2020 is going to go down in history as a, I think we were talking about this a little bit before, as a critical realigning election, or as the continuation of 2016 as a critical realigning election. And I think that the realignment issue that is happening, there's a division in the country and it's reinforced. The big issue here is inequality, and that inequality is being reinforced on generational lines. And there is a huge, huge divide in the country between people who are millennial and younger and people who are older than them. And the younger people overwhelmingly want, or they want this transformative change. Their elders do not. And I think that those younger people are the future of the Democratic Party. And I think that if that scenario that we were talking about before of a really, really bitter convention, and especially a bitter convention where Bernie walks in with the most delegates but does not walk out as the nominee, mm-hmm. I think will be a bitter blow to his supporters, who are overwhelmingly the younger side of Democratic people who identify as Democratic and constituencies that are traditionally the Democratic constituencies.
I know quite a number of Vermonters. Now, obviously, you know, I'm in this bubble up here in this liberal northeastern state, but I know quite a number of Vermonters who tell me that in 2016 they voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary. Remember, he got 26% of the vote on that first Tuesday in, or I'm sorry, 86% of the vote in Vermont on that first Tuesday in March 4 years ago. And then Hillary Clinton got enough of the vote in Vermont on general election day that you can just see by the sheer numbers that many, many people in Vermont voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary and then for Hillary Clinton in the general. I look at that and I kind of feel as though sometimes this whole story about how Bernie Sanders supporters disappeared in 2016 or went and voted for Jill Stein or something, rarer than advertised, is the way I sort of read that. Do you agree or do you think I'm off the track here?
No, I agree. I think that most people who supported Bernie then supported Hillary, and I think a huge part of it is they supported Bernie, and they also sort of looked to Bernie. And I personally think that it's an unfair accusation that people make that he didn't support Clinton in 2016. He held dozens of rallies for her.
I always ask, who did more for which candidate, Bernie Sanders for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 general, or say John Kasich for Donald Trump in the 2016 general? I mean, there's no comparison. All those other Republicans really did disappear, as far as I recall, in the 2016 general election. A lot of people didn't think Trump was going to win, which, of course, he ended up doing. So,
but I do think 2020 is different. I mean, there's 2016, Bernie was a surprise phenomenon.
Yeah.
2020, he is the front runner.
Yeah.
And I do think that if he walks into the convention as the front runner,
and doesn't get nominated,
yep, people will perceive that differently than
I fear that you're right, and essentially what you're saying is that the 2016 story, as we just called it, is gonna might end up playing out in 2020, which would be, of course, for the Democrats and for, you know, anybody who is to the left somewhere of Donald Trump, a disaster. But you know, that's what could play out. And do you think that the flip side of this, that moderates might be upset with the nomination of Bernie Sanders? Will they feel that as intensely, and will they be as likely to disappear?
I think yes. I think that could happen as well.
Wow. Yikes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that.
So either way, the Democrats are in big trouble.
The Democrats, I think, face a real challenge, and I don't know that for sure, and I also think that we should remember the same thing that we were talking about at the very beginning, that we're still actually really early in the process.
Yeah.
And it's just in the span of a week, things change so fast right now.
Yeah, sure. And, of course, 2 days from now, we'll be late in the process. I don't know if late is.
Yeah, well, yeah. 2 days from now, we'll at least be in the middle of the process.
That's for sure. You know? Hey, let's bring in another listener. Marsha's on the line for Barry. Good morning, Marsha.
Morning, everybody, and thank you. I'm wondering if the professor knows about the phenomenon of the other swing voter that was written about by Professor Kendi, who wrote the how to be an anti-racist, and he just recently wrote an article about the other swing voter. I think it's in the Atlantic.
Define the other swing voter. I missed this.
Okay. Well, what it is, it's a voter who goes for a candidate with great enthusiasm, like I do for Bernie. I am an oldie for Bernie, and if our candidate isn't nominated, what usually happens is that the voter either doesn't vote, which is not me, or goes to a third party, mm-hmm, which has been me for all of my voting life. and this is a new thing. It's a new category of swing voter.
Yeah. I think that's kind of what we're talking about here, Monica, and I appreciate your call, and thank you very much. Let's go to Dick in Waterbury.
Morning. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Hello. Good. Couple questions. First question, I wonder what the Democrats are going to do if Bernie wins the nomination, maybe even more importantly, wins the presidency. How are the Democrats going to react?
That's kind of what we've been talking about. And Professor Ciplon, I think you were just saying that you wouldn't be surprised if some of the moderates and the sort of mainstream of the Democratic Party react pretty negatively to a Bernie Sanders nomination.
I think that obviously there's still one unifying theme, and that is that pretty much anybody at this point, I would say, who identifies in the Democratic Party really, really wants Trump out. And, you know, that is, there's nothing like a common enemy to make people sort of, and I would almost put it in those terms. It's not even a common opponent. I think that this is the most polarized the country's been on a president in a super long time. And so having that common target, you know, that's also different than 2016.
You know, that's really interesting, because a moment ago you were saying that, and we were kind of agreeing, I think I was, that the Democrats might be heading for a bit of a disaster here if they so displease either the Bernie supporters or the non-Bernie supporters, let's say. And yet there's this giant unifying force out there called Donald Trump.
Yep.
Wow.
Ironically, that he is in an ironic way, a gift to the Democratic Party in terms of being almost the singular unifying force.
Yeah, he definitely has a certain talent there. One would say, Dick, what do you think? Do you think that's likely? I guess Dick is gone. He's off the line. Hey, well, this is really a fascinating conversation. We should probably get back together in a couple of weeks or so, Trish Siplon of St. Michael's College, and kind of review where we are then, because obviously a lot of this stuff is a giant moving target at this point. So I really appreciate you joining me this morning then.
Yeah, this has been great. Thank you so much for having me on.
All righty. Trish Siplon is a professor of political science at St. Michael's College. And I want to also thank Lola Duffert and Joanna Doria, my first hour guests this morning. That's about it for this edition of the Dave Graham Show. Don't forget to vote tomorrow, folks. It's primary day. It's town meeting day. Get out and do your civic duty. And we'll talk to you all tomorrow morning. Have a great day. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio.